Violin Concerto by Nikolai Miaskovsky was played by Vadim Repin with the Kirov Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. Well, that's all for another Sunday morning. Thanks for your company. I'm James Jolly, and I hope you've enjoyed my selection of music today. I'm back for a brace of Sundays next month, but do try and join Rob next Sunday at the usual time of 9 o'clock. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners. It's just after 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest this week is the artistic director of the Young Vic, David Lann.
David Lann is a major force in British theatre, indeed in theatre around the world. Quite how he got there is rather surprising. Born in South Africa, he started out as an anthropologist and lived for 2 years in a remote area of Zimbabwe studying spirit magic. He went on to become a playwright and documentary director, and he's also written the libretto for 2 operas. In 2000, he became artistic director of the Young Vic, where he led the £12.5 million theatre rebuild. And over the last 14 years, he's established a reputation for persuading directors and stars from all over the world to come to London. The productions have been wildly inventive and critically successful. A Doll's House, Three Sisters, A View from the Bridge. His latest role, announced this year, is consulting artistic director for the New York Arts Centre, which is still being built on the site of the 9/11 attacks. So, it's a very rich career, David, with surprising twists and turns. Are you surprised, by the way, it's turned out?
Nothing was planned. I find I simply do the next thing that turns up, and if somebody's got a really good suggestion, I'm always glad to hear it.
You were brought up, as I said, in South Africa, in Cape Town, and I think your musical education, in one sense, began with your grandmother, who ran a record shop that also sold bicycles.
That's right. It didn't occur to me until much later that there was a kind of poetic connection between bicycle wheels and 33 RPM records, but she did. It was a shop called Rex. Why it was called Rex, I haven't a clue, but my grandfather, when they came to South Africa from Lithuania, as many Jewish people did in the 20s, they spoke Russian, they didn't speak English, and his job was a typesetter. They were intellectuals, they were Trotskyists, actually, and he wrote journalism to some extent, but really he was a typesetter. So when he came to South Africa, because he couldn't speak English, he couldn't work in the new language until he'd learnt it. And my grandmother was an orphan. She was orphaned during the First World War, and she was a dressmaker, and she set up a little practice as a dressmaker, which is the one skill that she had. And that somehow, I don't know quite how, that dressmaking shop turned into, well, I guess they went, we've got a little shop, what should we sell? And they started to sell bicycles, and then records became more available. These were, you know, poor people, really, and she started to sell records. And I remember as a kid, I mean, one of my very, very earliest memories is being taken around to the house of people called Burlak, I remember their name, and they were particularly lovers of music, and they used to listen to their music by piling up all the records one on top of each other on the spindle, and you'd hear, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, and then it'd go like clunk, and the next record would fall down, and somehow that was kind of fine. That's what music was.
One of the pieces from that period is the first you've chosen, and I think there's also a connection for you here, because both the musicians playing Beethoven's Third Cello Sonata, Rostropovich and Richter, are Russian.
Yeah, Richter is still my favourite pianist. There's something about his playing which I love and have loved for a very long time. And this recording of the Beethoven Cello Sonata with Rostropovich, had for many, many years. And there's something about the muscularity of the playing, particularly of the piano playing, but also of the cello playing, the sort of power of it, just the physical power of it, when the music itself is so delicate and lyrical. I think it's great.
Thank you.
It's wonderful, the attack of both players, actually, isn't it?
Oh, it's the pairing, which is fantastic, I think, yeah.
Mstislav Rostropovich performing the third movement from Beethoven's Cello Sonata No. 3 in A. Sviatoslav Richter was playing the piano. Next, David, a composer I think was just about your favourite.
Shostakovich, yeah, he is. I think if I had to pick one, I don't know why I would have to, but if I had to, I guess the composer I feel closest to, despite the fact that he wrote 100 different kinds of music, is Dmitri Shostakovich, yes.
And is that partially, do you think, because he did live within the constraints of the Stalinist purges and was constantly having to almost reinvent himself to survive?
I don't know why it is. I mean, there's the lyricism, there's the just physical forcefulness of a lot of the music, and always the irony, often a very kind of bitter irony, behind which he seems to be hiding in a way. I mean, I guess if you live in a totalitarian society where the dictator, Stalin in this case, not only thinks he knows everything there is to know about the economy and farming and chemistry and rocket science, but also music theory, I think it must be quite a challenge just to go home and write the music you really want to write.
Well, so this is his piano quintet in G minor, opus 57, of which this is the intermezzo, the fourth movement.
Thank you.
The intermezzo from Shostakovich's quintet for piano and strings in G major, played by the Nash Ensemble, whose pianist is Ian Brown. The story of how Shostakovich did manage to survive Stalin, despite falling from favour and losing many friends and fellow musicians to the purges, is pretty dramatic. And I wonder whether you ever felt, David Land, that maybe in some small way you experienced aspects of that when you were brought up in South Africa during a time of considerable political turbulence.
Look, as a kid when I was at university in Cape Town in the very early 70s, it was a very turbulent time in many ways. And yes, I was, in a very small way, caught up in that. I was a white kid from a privileged background. I mean, whatever I was involved with politically was fascinating and sometimes a bit frightening. But you could always go home, get away from it. And actually, after a year or two of that, I left altogether and came to this country. So, I mean, to compare oneself with people in the circumstances he was, or indeed the circumstances majority black population South Africa lived in, really, I had a very easy time of it.
Nevertheless, you did once, in order to get home, have to walk a rather long way, didn't you? Because you were conscripted into the army.
Oh, right, yes, I was indeed, yeah. I was conscripted into the army. Everybody was at that point. I was 17 and there was nothing you could do about it. Yeah, I mean, the long walk was when I wasn't in the army very long. I was very lucky indeed because I discovered quite early on that I simply couldn't do this thing. I couldn't do it. I mean, I was physically perfectly capable, and I guess in right circumstances I might have felt I could carry a gun and use it, maybe, I don't know. But the army that I was conscripted into was a fascist army, and the purpose of training us was to participate in the colonial wars. South Africa had a number of secret wars going on at the time, in Angola particularly, but also in Mozambique. And in the camp that I was billeted in, there were, you know, very young people who were coming back from, despite that had very little training, they were sent up to Angola, where they were fighting the Cubans. I mean, gosh. And I couldn't do that. And I managed to persuade people in charge of the camp to let me go. It's a long story. But I spent a couple of months in the camp, and in a hospital in the camp. And eventually they said, look, just go. And the sort of comical aspect to it is that having been in this ward for that period of time and going, look, actually, you know, I can barely walk. They said go, and they didn't give me transport to the station, which was, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles away. I just walked that distance, and all the time waiting for somebody to pop up from behind a tree and say, look, you're walking perfectly well. There's nothing wrong with you. Come back to the camp and go and fight the Cubans. But they didn't.
Your next music has South African connection. It's the title track from Paul Simon's 1986 album Graceland, a collaboration, of course, with many South African musicians, and in particular the Ladysmith Black Mambazo Choir.
I think Paul Simon is great in every way. I think he's a great lyricist. I think he's a great poet. I love the music. I love this track because it's so mysterious and is doing so many different things at the same time. It's a very apparently simple lyric. It's just about this guy and his son, the child of his first marriage, 9-year-old, they're going to Graceland, the museum built in the home of Elvis Presley. But if you really listen to the very delicate lyric, you realise he's a really great artist.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. Following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War, I'm going to Graceland, Graceland, to Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. And my traveling companion is 9 years old. He's the child of my first marriage. She comes back to tell me she's gone. As if I didn't know that, as if I didn't know my own bed. As if I'd never noticed the way she brushed her hair from her forehead. And she said, losing love is like a window in your heart. Everybody sees you're blown apart. Everybody sees the wind blow. I'm going to Graceland, Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. Am I traveling? Ghosts and empty sockets, I'm looking at ghosts and empties. But I've reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland. There is a girl in New York City who calls herself a human trampoline. Sometimes when I'm falling, flying, tumbling in turmoil, I say, whoa, so this is what she means. She means we're bouncing into Graceland. And I see losing love is like a window in your heart. Well, everybody sees you're blown apart. Everybody feels the wind blow. Ooh, in Graceland. Graceland, I'm going to Graceland. For reasons I cannot explain, there's some part of me wants to see Graceland. And I may be obliged to defend every love, every ending, or maybe there's no obligations now. Maybe I have a reason to believe we all will.
Paul Simon with Graceland. You yourself went back to South Africa, David Lamb, after you'd taken a degree in anthropology at the LSE in London. For 2 years you lived alongside people who were extremely poor, indeed who had nothing. Tell me about that time, harrowing in some ways.
Well, it didn't feel like a unusual or remarkable thing to be doing, except when I set out, as it happened, the place I chose to do that participant observation was the Zambezi Valley immediately after the end of the War for the Liberation of Zimbabwe, just at the time when Rhodesia finally gave up being Rhodesia and became Zimbabwe. And I was really interested in what political resistance looked like if you were a peasant farmer. And a lot of the time that I was there, most of the first year, it was quite dangerous. Quite quickly, I made friends with people and then became quite close to people who were living there. And I guess I felt if they've got to put up with it, then so do I. It was a little bit different because I was very conspicuous, having a bright white skin. But nonetheless, that didn't feel like enough of a reason to go. Eventually, it got so dangerous that I left. I remember arriving at the farm store where the white farmers also used to go and buy things, and a woman coming up to me and saying, oh, goodness me, we heard you'd been taken out.
You wrote a rather wonderful anthropological study, I think.
Well, I wrote a book.
Guns and Rain.
Gorillas
and Spirit Mediums.
Yeah, Gorillas and Spirit Mediums. The guns are the gorillas and the rain is the spirit mediums, because one of the things that the mediums did was to bring the rain, or so people believed. You know, if you drive through that kind of countryside, if you're in India and you go through the countryside, it's just full of temples and, you know, wonderful expressions of rich and complex and very old culture. If you drive through the Central African bush, it appears to be there's nothing there. Actually, if you just stop and hang out, you discover that, you know, every tree has a meaning. Every rock is known to somebody as their special rock. You know, the air is just full of all kinds of wonderful philosophical ideas about the nature of life on a particular piece of land. And I try to write about that in the book.
You've talked about the magic of the spirit mediums bringing the rain, for instance. In fact, a lot of your work since has had links to magic. And in fact, the next piece is the overture to Mozart's Magic Flute. But there's a difference.
One of the pleasures of running the theatre in the way that we do is we do a lot of collaborations, co-productions with theatre companies in other parts of the world. We've worked all over the place, in Brazil and in Iceland and all over Europe and in the States and so on. But one of the most memorable collaborations we did was with a theatre company called Sango, which is made up of singers and performers and musicians, many of whom live in a township just outside Cape Town called Khayelitsha. And somehow we came up with the idea of doing Magic Flute. And I spent quite a lot of time with them in Cape Town when they were rehearsing this with this brilliant kind of genius MD called Mandisi Gentis, who transcribed the whole of the score for marimbas with these big kind of wooden xylophones. And one of the experiences of that production, which is now played all over the world, it played in London, it's played in Paris, it's been all over the place, is people hearing this, you know, very well-known overture, but played on marimbas, people often find their eyes just full of tears.
The overture to Mozart's Magic Flute in an arrangement that we don't often hear on Radio 3 for marimbas by Mandisi Diantis, performed by the Isango Ensemble. It produces an extraordinary sense of cultural shift, different cultures touching. And that's something you've tried to do as artistic director at the Young Vic by inviting, David Lann, directors from across the world.
Yeah, very much. Bring different ideas. And there's a simpler version of it as well, which is just inviting people whose work I fall in love with, really. I mean, I travel quite a lot and see quite a lot of work. And from time to time, I see something that I just feel is exceptional, and often I can't explain why, but you go, I want that, I want to work with that person. And it's just feeling the world is open to us and we can work with whoever we choose to.
Do you think otherwise we tend to be rather insular in Britain?
In the theatre, yes. I mean, not in music, not in opera, not in dance, certainly not in the visual arts, not at all in the visual arts. But in theatre, yes. And I've never quite understood why that is. People go because of the language, but actually, no, you can find ways through language. Not in film, of course. I mean, in film, we are very familiar with great European film directors and so on. But in theatre, yes, we have this curious idea that the theatre in this country is the best in the world. And actually, that's just marketing. If you travel in Europe, if you spend any time in Berlin or in Warsaw or Leningrad or in South America, Sao Paulo, the theatre in Sao Paulo is fantastic. And you run a theatre, it's impossible not to think that the job is to find a way of bringing all that to us as well.
You've written the libretto for two operas, and probably the best known is the collaboration with Jonathan Dove, Tobias and the Angel, first staged in 1999. Story from Scripture, the Book of Tobit, which again, of course, has got magic in it, hasn't it?
Yeah, the magic, which is the heart of the story, because in a way which he can't predict and doesn't know it's going to happen, Tobias, who's sent off on a journey by his father, who's gone blind for a reason none of them can understand, and he's sent off to find money, he comes back with the magic or the medicine, which turns out to be exactly what's required in order to cure his father's blindness. But he's lucky enough to have found a travelling companion who, at the very last moment in the story, is revealed to be the angel Gabriel.
My name is Tobit. I will run.
The final chorus of Jonathan Dove's Tobias and the Angel, conducted by David Charles Abell, with soloist Maureen Brathwaite, and words by my guest today, David Lann. Not his choice, but ours, because we wanted to share it with you. All the details of today's music are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Your current role as Artistic Director of the Young Vic involves you often in following people right round the world, trying to persuade directors to come and work for you. And that's how you discovered this next music.
Yeah, there's a director who I'd seen his work when I first came to England in the early 70s at this production of played by Marivaux, Les Disputes, that Patrice Chabrol did when he was a relatively young man, which I saw at the National Theatre and which completely just took my breath away. I met him and I very much wanted Patrice to do a production for us and thought I could persuade him by going to see everything that he did and thereby suggesting that I was kind of serious. And I went to Paris to see a reading that he did. Patrice was also a very fine actor as well as a director. And a filmmaker, but he did this reading of the Grand Inquisitor from the Brothers Karamazov, and he was scheduled to do it at the Odeon. I went to Paris to see it, and when I arrived in Paris, having bought my ticket and, you know, done all that, I noticed on a poster that Nina Simone was on that very same evening. And I could only be in Paris that one night, and I remember standing in the beautiful foyer of the Odeon thinking, oh God, what do I do? And Nina Simone... one. I went to hear her at the Olympia in Paris, and it was a spectacular concert. It was the only time I saw her, and her brilliantly or contemptuous manner with the audience while singing these very emotionally powerful songs was a great experience. And one of the songs she sang that night was, I think, my favourite of all her songs, and it's called Don't Explain.
Hush now, don't explain. There ain't nothing to gain. I'm glad that you're back. Explain. Quiet, baby. Don't explain. There is nothing to gain. Explain. You know that I love you and what love endures. All my thoughts are of you, for I'm so completely yours. Don't wanna hear folks chatter, 'cause I know you cheat. Right and wrong don't matter when you're with me, my sweet. Hush now, don't explain. You know you're my joy and you're my pain. My life is yours, love. Don't explain. Of you, for I'm so completely yours. I don't want to hear nobody chatter, 'cause I know
your cheek. Right and wrong don't matter when you're with me, my sweet. Hush now, don't explain. You're my joy, you're my pain. My life is yours, love. Don't explain.
It's quite an unusual take on the theme of the unfaithful lover.
Yeah, it's forgiving. It's completely grown up, almost unachievably grown up, in the sense that the person singing the song is saying, I know you will never be the person I want you to be. I know that's not going to happen, but I can't help it. I'm in love with you. And don't start telling me why you betrayed me. I don't want to know. Which gives the song its title, Don't Explain. And in a way, that's the sort of badge I'd quite like to wear.
One of the constants in your life, through all the shifts in career, has been your partnership with the distinguished playwright and director Nicholas Wright. And he's the author of many award-winning plays, like Vincent in Brixton. And you met when you were only 17, I think.
Yeah, no, I was very young. Just legal, I think. I was in London between ending school and having to go back to Cape Town to go into the army. I was on holiday, and we met at the Royal Court Theatre, where he'd started the theatre upstairs as the first studio theatre in this country. We met then, and apart from, well, one of the 2 years I was in Zimbabwe, he was... It's in England, the second year he was with me there. And one other time when we thought, that's enough, we can't do this anymore, and I left. And I left for, an hour and a half, I think. And I called up and said, and we both went, oh, this is a bit silly, isn't it? But we've been together in one way or another.
And he's helped since you quite a lot with music education, hasn't he? Because he's very, loves music.
Yeah, but I mean, he's helped me in many, many ways. I mean, and it's partly watching him and other friends of mine who are on theatres thinking, oh, come on, if these people can do it, then hey, you know, maybe I can too. But more recently, well, I haven't, because of the hours I work at the theatre, I don't hear as much music as I would like to. When I get home of an evening, he always has music on, and it's completely unpredictable. It could be anything from anywhere.
There's a rather extraordinary correspondence, if you like, between your job with the Young Vic, which after all was built on a bomb site, and your new role as artistic director of an art centre that's going to be built on the site of the Twin Towers. Given that this theatre is going to be on this site, which has so many profound associations for so many people, do you think theatre has a kind of power to heal, to bring some kind of resolution?
Well, you don't want to be too ambitious or self-important or, God forbid, self-righteous about it. We make theatre because it's fun, it's enjoyable to do, and also it's the thing that we know how to do, and so you do it. You don't want to claim too much. But one of the pleasures for me in my building is that, as it happens, it was built on a bomb site, and it is something I think about from time to time, that where there was destruction and a great deal of pain and suffering, there is now the making of beautiful things. At the World Trade Center, of course, everything about that site will be, probably for centuries to come, in some way a commemoration of what happened there on one particular day. What we're trying to do is build a new building in which new life can be born. People can make great, wonderful, unexpected, surprising things in it. And if we achieve that, that's enough.
I'm interested that your final choice today is another piece that makes an unexpected connection between musical cultures. I mean, we've had Mozart on marimbas, and this is a meeting between jazz and Bach, a connection, of course, that's often made. It's a Bach prelude and fugue, but played by the jazz pianist Keith Jarrett.
Well, I first heard Jarrett, as I guess many people do, which is the Cologne concert, which is an amazing exploration journey into jazz forms. But and I didn't know that he also played this kind of music. I first heard the Shostakovich preludes, actually, that he's recorded. And then I started to listen to these recordings, and they are different from how pianists from a different tradition would play them. Exactly what the difference is, I don't have the expertise to say, but there is a lightness, a dexterity, a freeness maybe in the playing, which is very exciting. And it, as always, it's the juxtaposition, the contrast, the contradiction that seems to create energy. Thank you.
Keith Jarrett performing the prelude and fugue in E-flat major from the first book of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. In fact, he also said, Jarrett talking about Bach, that he felt it was nutritious. It was like taking vitamins.
Yeah, I can see that. Vitamins that go straight to the brain. It's chance, I think, but it's great to have had Richter at the beginning of this, and with Richter's sort of muscular pounding fingers and Jarrett's delicacy and lightness and sort of wristy technique at the end, both great in their different ways.
Well, thank you, David Land, for bookending the programme with those two pieces, and indeed for all the nice surprises that came in between.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions was David Land, the artistic director of the Young Vic. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. You can download a podcast of that programme and others in the series if you go to the podcasts page on the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the actress Keke Markham.
This evening, Radio 3 lifts the curtain on Chinese theatre. At 6:45, Rana Mitter travels to Beijing to explore the recent flourishing of theatre in China. And at 10 o'clock, Drama on 3 presents the cult hit Rhinoceros in Love, a runaway success in China. Liao Yimei's play is a dark romance about a rhinoceros keeper, Mai Lu, who falls in love with his beautiful neighbour, Ming Ming.
You seemed as lonely as I was. I suddenly felt I had a purpose to make you happy. You are someone worth doing something for.
Enter the Dragon. Chinese theatre in the 21st century at 6:45 and 10 p.m. this evening here on BBC Radio 3.
Remarkable play that. If you're a budding playwright, it's a masterclass in experimental black comedy. Well worth a listen. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. Welcome along to the afternoon here on Radio 3, which continues in a couple of minutes with our lunchtime concert today, a chance to hear the music played live last Monday on Radio 3 from Wigmore Hall in London. The Cremona Quartet playing Webern and Beethoven. But let's have a summary of the BBC News first this lunchtime. It's read by Katriona Young.
The outgoing president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, has said that Britain could lose all its influence in Europe if it left the EU. Speaking on the Andrew Marr programme, Mr Barroso also cautioned against any attempt by David Cameron to limit the number of migrants coming to the UK from the rest of the EU. The leader of Roman Catholics in England and Wales has said the decision of bishops to vote against plans to reform the church's position on gay and divorce people is just the start of a process. At the end of a two-week synod, the Vatican failed to get the required two-thirds majority of bishops to back its call for greater openness. But Cardinal Vincent Nichols said it wasn't an end and the synod would reconvene in a year's time. Victims of online abuse have welcomed proposals for longer prison sentences for abusers. The Justice Secretary, Chris Grayling, said people who published abusive or threatening material on Twitter or other sites could face up to 2 years in prison. The current maximum sentence for what's known as trolling is 6 months. A government official in Nepal has said there are now no trekkers left stranded in the Himalayas, and rescue teams are focusing on collecting bodies trapped under snow following the severe storms in the area last week. It's unclear how many people may still be missing in the country's worst ever trekking disaster. At least 39 people are known to have died. The chair of the government's Social Mobility Commission says urgent action is needed to stop today's generation from being worse off than their parents. Speaking ahead of a report out tomorrow, the former Labour Cabinet Minister Alan Milburn said the recession had been especially hard on the young and they'd missed out on the recovery. Thousands of runners have battled thick smog to run the Beijing Marathon, despite high levels of pollution that forced some competitors to wear face masks. Organisers rejected calls to postpone the event, saying they'd laid on extra medical staff. And the weather, it'll be a warm afternoon with sunny spells in most southern areas, but blustery showers will move across northern and central parts at times, accompanied by strong winds or gales. And that's the BBC News and weather.
Triana, thank you very much. In an hour from now, a concert of sacred choral music, specially recorded for Radio 3 and the Early Music Show to mark the 400th anniversary of the death of the composer of the music we'll be enjoying, Hans Leo Hassler. You can hear the music he wrote in the Early Music Show at 2 o'clock this afternoon. But first, we have another chance to hear last Monday's live lunchtime concert. It was presented by Petroc Trelawney.
Hello. Today we welcome the Cremona Quartet to Wigmore Hall, founded in 2000 at the Conservatoire in the Italian city that provides the quartet with its name. They've received great reviews for their recent Beethoven cycle on CD, and today we'll play a late quartet, Opus 131 in C-sharp minor, the quartet that Beethoven is said to have considered his finest. To begin, music from the very start of the 20th century, a slow movement that Anton Webern wrote while studying in Vienna with Schoenberg. In the spring of 1905, Webern had taken a hiking holiday in Lower Austria with his wife-to-be, a joyous trip which provided the inspiration for this music. The work was further influenced by the late romantic music that Schoenberg was writing at the turn of the century. The Cremona Quartet make their way onto the platform to open our Radio 3 Wigmore Hall lunchtime concert with Webern's Langsamer Satz.